Hello. Before you start this episode of The Game Changers, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our new documentary, Abby Ward, A Bump in the Road, which explores the challenges faced by professional female athletes and all working mothers. It follows the remarkable journey of an England rugby player as she battles back to the professional game just 17 weeks after the birth of her baby, and then on to secure her place in England's Six Nations squad for 2024. The documentary is free to watch in the UK on ITVX or globally on Rugby Pass TV. And don't forget that our other documentary, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport, is still available to watch on Netflix in the UK. Now it's time for the Game Changers. Hello and welcome to the Game Changers podcast, where you'll hear from trailblazing, fearless women in sport. I'm Sue Anstis, and in this episode, it's hockey legend Kate Richardson-Walsh, OBE. With a record 375 caps for her country, Kate was England and GB captain for 13 years, culminating in that superb Olympic hockey gold at Rio in 2016. Such a privilege to catch up with Kate as she talks openly about the highs and lows in her incredible career and her future plans. I was lucky enough to meet Kate at the very trendy Groucho Club in London. It was quite a warm day, so the air conditioning is a little loud in the background, but hopefully that won't detract from what was a wonderful conversation with one of our country's best known female athletes. To start the interview, I asked Kate about her first memories of picking up a hockey stick.
My first real proper memories would be playing hockey properly at school. So it would be it was a PE lesson, secondary school, on the red grass pitch at Priestnall School in Stockport. And I think Mrs. Kinder, our PE teacher, would have dragged out the rubbish bin full of wooden hockey sticks that had seen better days. And we all just grabbed one. And I think that was my first proper hockey session. My sister and I both watched my mum play as little girls, but there was no junior section or anything at my mum's club, so we couldn't play, but we did have little, sawn-off hockey sticks that we would terrorise people with on the sideline. But we didn't properly play until we were secondary school.
And did you love it straight away, do you think?
I think I loved it most is that it was with other people, because up to that point I'd been doing gymnastics and swimming. And although you are around people in both of those sports, it is quite solitary. I found it quite solitary. I remember in gymnastics, my overriding memory is just being left with a mat saying, just go and do as many backward walkovers until you've cracked it. And the same with swimming, you know, the session would be put on the float at the end, and you would just go and follow what it said, and you would just be up and down doing that. So whereas the first time I was around other people, and I think that's the thing I loved.
And did you mentioned other sports, so gymnastics, swimming, was there anything, once you knew you'd found hockey, was that the sport for you then forever, do you feel?
I kept swimming, so I was swimming at Stockport Metro, and then I started swimming at Stockport Swimming Club. And so probably up to the age of about 14, we were still going to swimming training two or three nights a week, because hockey still then was only really at school, and then I joined Disbury Grays Hockey Club. But other than that, I did athletics and netball and rounders at school, but other than that, we didn't have the opportunity to really play anything else. You know, I look now and I go into schools and I see them doing rugby and football and fencing and goodness knows what, and we just didn't have that opportunity. But I did every sport, I guess, I could at school.
And we hear a lot, obviously, you and I both involved with Team Up and the Women's Sport Trust, about teenage girls dropping out of sport.
Yeah.
Was that a risk for you, do you think, or was that never a consideration?
Was it a risk? No, I mean, I did go through the teenage years of being an absolute pain in my parents' backsides. And
surely not.
Yeah. It was, you know, trying to find out who I was, really, and not really getting anywhere. So just copying and falling in line with other people. So going to the park, drinking, doing things I shouldn't have been doing.
So very reassuring for other teenage girls. Yeah. That was the case.
Not for parents, partner. But yeah. And... it came to a head when I was dropped from the England under-16s, so I would have been age 15. And I guess at that point it was a crossroads. I mean, now looking back, it was a crossroads. I had to either decide to really look after myself, play hockey a bit more seriously, make better decisions, make better choices, or carry on doing what I was doing and being a bit of a rebel. And I think if I had chosen that path and just continued to go to the park, and I would have fallen out of love with sport, and yeah, I would have been one of those statistics of teenage girls that drop out of sport. I think it's that easy.
And what made you, do you think, choose that path at that time? Did you have your eyes set on a goal for the future?
I hadn't up to that point, and it was being dropped, I think, gave me a bit of a wake-up call to say, actually, I'm so upset about this. I'm so embarrassed and angry, and then actually, why am I feeling so emotional about it? Well, I actually care. So I think, and I had my parents were just brilliant at that moment, just kind of asking me some really good questions and asking me what I wanted to do about it and supporting me in making really good choices from that point on. So choosing which college I went to, which hockey club I joined. My dad, love him, drove me and my sister an hour and 45 there and back twice a week to go to a new club. So without that support, without, you know, being able to make those choices and decisions, I don't think I would, well, I certainly wouldn't be sitting here talking to you now.
I was going to ask you about your mum, actually, because I don't know her, but I feel I know her through social media and Twitter and whatever. But clearly they have been, as parents, a massive support to your achievements, to getting you there.
Yeah, so. Both my mum and dad were both really sporty. It was the norm. You know, weekends were spent at the club. Disbury Greys and Disbury Cricket Club was in the same club, so we would be there in the winter watching hockey or in the summer watching cricket. And yeah, they've always, you know, whether they can be with us watching or not, and they were always being supportive of myself and my sister.
And I'm going to come on to talk a bit about role models, but who were your role models, do you think, as, you know, 14, 15, 16?
I mean, the one person I really vividly remember on TV was Sally Gunnell.
Yeah, yeah.
She'll slap me when she sees me because she's making her feel old. But, the 92 Olympics, just the moment of her crossing that finish line and the utter relief, I think, initially, and then joy of achieving her dream. And you know, the BBC do a lovely montage when you're on the podium.
Like a BBC montage.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that whole thing, you know, it really gripped me. But realistically, it was probably the people around me. So my mom and my PE teacher, Mrs. Kinder, who she'll tell me off calling her Mrs. Kinder still, but Bev, they were both just really sporty women, loved their jobs, you know, they had families, they were just gave their energy to other people all the time. So I'd say those two.
It's fantastic to hear, isn't it? The impact that they, knowing they have that now moving
massive
forward and so on.
Yeah.
And I should have known this, but I'm not sure I did until I've researched you well in the last few weeks. But you were captain at 23. I don't know why I hadn't thought that you were, you know, captain so young, but at such a young age. And then onwards for 13 years. So I guess so much pressure for so long. Did you ever wish you could just have been a member of the squad and the team and not have had all that additional pressure to perform?
I think I've ever been asked that question before.
Yay!
yes, I think I would be lying if I said no. There were absolutely moments when I just wanted to, I don't know, maybe let my hair down a little bit. Like we all do, have a little bit of a wild side. And I did feel, particularly in the beginning, I really felt like I had to hide certain parts of myself. Wrongly, actually, it turns out. But it took me a long time to really understand that me just being genuine and authentic actually would help other people be able to be that as well. But it took me a long time to realise that. And so, you know, I could be a bit cheeky at times and a little bit mischievous, and that was okay, because that's part of me. But it's just picking and choosing your times and understanding the group and the people around you. But yeah, there were times when I wanted to take that responsibility off me. But for the most part, I loved it.
Yeah. And were you a very different captain at the end to where you were at the beginning? How do you feel you changed your style or manner of being a captain?
In my head, it's like night and day, the difference between what I was like in the beginning and the end. But I mean, it'll be interesting to see what other people that I've never asked them. I guess the core of me probably stayed the same. So what I believed to be my role, so setting the best example that I could, encouraging other people to be the best that they could and helping them be that, trying to be that link with the coach and with players. And I think that in its essence was what I tried to do the whole way through. I think how I went about that changed. I think I went on a bit of a journey as a person, as you know, hopefully we all do, just learning about how I can be the best of myself, and that I can't be all things to all people all the time, and that, you know, to recognise my ego and to understand the strengths of the group and how many leaders we had in those squads, particularly in the lead up to London and Rio in particular, and that they need to be able to lead as well, and that's part of my responsibility as captain to encourage that and support that. And I think that's part of the thing that I kicked myself a bit about. I genuinely only really feel like I got into my stride as captain in literally the last couple of years. But I guess it's the way of life that you're never finished. You're never the finished article.
Were you coached as a captain? I mean, could you obviously follow the captain that you follow? You look at what they've done. Did anybody give you guidance on being a great captain in the role and so on?
No, I did follow. That's what I did do. That's my kind of go-to behaviour, is to copy. So I copied the captain that I thought had done an amazing job prior to me. No, I just read a lot.
Yeah.
I read lots of different books. I listened to lots of different interviews and read articles and just tried to formulate my own ideas. And I guess leadership in general, and in business in particular, has become such a massive topic, and there are so many books. Yeah.
Podcasts.
Exactly, yeah. So that's kind of helped be part of that journey, yeah. I suppose, yeah.
And I'm going to obviously come on to talk about massive success, but in terms of a bit of the podcast is looking at overcoming challenges and failures, and I guess there was that time you were a very young captain and then not getting, you know, qualifying for Athens and so on. So looking back now, how do you think you personally cope with that disappointment and as captain for the team as well?
I mean, I still feel it. It's still, I mean, it's so long ago, but it's still so raw.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's because it was such a moment in time. I don't think we ever believed that would happen as that group. And, you know, for some of those women, that was the very last time they would put on that international shirt and represent their country or have the opportunity to even try and be selected for Olympics. And that's where it all ended. And so it really was a fire in me. You know, instead of it pressing me down, I used it to continually fire me up, that if I ever felt low or that I couldn't, you know, I was there representing them and I had this opportunity and I had to take it. My mum gave me a brilliant picture once it was lightning with a quote underneath, and I can't remember the whole quote, but it was something along the lines of something, you have to make the best of with whichever situation you are faced. And that I think is how I've tried to think. There's so many things that go wrong all of the time, on the hockey pitch, off the hockey pitch, in life, in relationships, just trying to make the best of it, because often so much good comes out of those dark times.
And do you think things change? It's fabulous advice as well. That is in terms of life advice, isn't it, really, and taking that on board for all ages. Do you think, well, what made the difference then on towards Beijing and then London and obviously Rio eventually? Do you think there was a shift in what happened with the team? Obviously funding made a big difference.
Funding made a massive difference. I think it was quite literally... I don't know what to say. It was the calm after the storm. So, you know, 2004 happened and it was awful. And then 2005, so a year later, we were awarded the Olympics for 2012, and we had Danny Carrick on board as a new coach. Yeah. And in that moment, it was just some of the pieces of the puzzle started to fit together. And not immediately, and I mean, it took a good few years to get there, but they at least started to be formed and start to see where we could go and how it might look. And that funding, that increase in funding, did really, really make a difference.
So one of my questions was going to be looking ahead to Rio.
Yay.
What had shifted there? But do you think it was a shift in training, mental training, physical training, or was it a gradual process from Beijing that culminated in Rio?
It was very gradual. I mean, there was one meeting when we started our centralised programme for the first time in 2009, when we sat in for the first time in this way, we sat and talked about our vision, our purpose, who we wanted to be. And we had done it before. We'd had mission statements. We'd had kind of goals. But this felt very different. This felt like a bit more of an empowerment, a bit more of responsibility for the players, which was brilliant of Danny and the staff to kind of, we were very much included in conversations on the programme, how many times a week we would train, the length of the sessions we would do. And therefore, we bought into what we were going to be about. And from the very beginning, and so in that meeting in February 2009, we established that we wanted our vision to be gold. And that's when slowly but surely it all started to change.
And was that different for the women's to the men's squad at the time? Were you a separate way of managing, and do you think, or was that England GB hockey?
It was very, it was really separate. We both squads could, you know, train how they wanted to train. I think they were given the opportunity to be centralised, to train full time. And it's different because it's they're in a very different situation to us. And I'd had a conversation with a couple of the guys and a couple of the Dutch guys as well. More recently, they couldn't understand, you know, why we had a centralised programme. And I was like, well, you are, for the most part, for the elite level, you're paid to play club hockey, or domestic club hockey, you're paid to play. Yes. And you have been for quite a few years, to a lesser or greater extent. I have always paid to play club hockey. You are able, therefore, to train kind of like a full-time mm-hmm. athlete. You've not had to work, whereas we have. And although it's not enough money that they're getting from club to sustain a full-time job, it has meant that they could be more flexible with their work. And we'd not had that, so we needed to train full-time. We needed that funding, and we needed time together. And so it was different. But they, you know, I mean, I recall a conversation in 2009 in a lift at the European Championships in Amsterdam. And one of the, I'm not going to name them, one of the Dutch player, male players, and one of the men's RGB England players, rather, kind of laughed at what we were doing, which I really took to heart and probably did fire me up a little bit for the foreseeable future. But there was no ability to see where we were coming from and what we needed and where we were going as a women's squad, and that it's, you know, maybe it is different to what they needed. But we genuinely believe this is what we needed, and thankfully, results came relatively quickly to prove our point.
Excellent. No, it's good. So good. Yeah, exactly. Proof in the pudding, isn't it?
Yeah.
The end of the day with the gold medal.
Yeah.
Says a lot too.
Well, it was 2010, so we'd only been doing a year centralised programme. We won our first world level medal, so we won our first Champions Trophy bronze, and we won a World Cup bronze, and then 2011 did we get another Champions Trophy bronze, and then 2012. Champions Trophy silver. So we were constantly on podiums that we'd never been on before. And so it was, proof was in the pudding.
And I guess we do a lot in the world of social media and communication. So looking at Rio, I've been really interested to hear that you were almost in a bit of a bubble, that kind of coming away from Twitter or LinkedIn or Facebook, wherever you were at the time. And do you think that made a significant difference, that coming away from it at the time for Rio?
Yeah, I mean, it took us a long time to get have 100% agreement, and if we hadn't had 100% agreement, we wouldn't have done it. But as players, we decided, after lots of really good open conversations from players, in both ways, you know, some players saying, you know, actually I want to stay on social media because this is my opportunity to create a bit of a
profile. Absolutely. Yeah.
You're on the world stage. And, you know, we had to listen to that point of view. You know, those of us who'd be like me, I was just like, well, you know, 2 weeks without it, I can do without it. You know, that actually the best way to get a profile of yourself is to go and win a gold medal. And I think the best way to do that is to come off it. But we had to listen to each other, and the good and the bad and the positives and the negatives. And after, I think it was about two or three meetings, we did all decide. I think it had an effect on us, in terms of, we were quite good with not having phones at meal times and stuff, because that's time you actually listen and talk to each other chat about stuff going on in your life in a really informal way. And if you've got your phone in front of your face, you're not doing that.
Welcome to my house.
Yeah, well, most people's lives. I'm really bad. I'm just as bad. So that was important. I think some people in our squad had some real negative interactions, unfortunately, on Twitter in particular. I'd had a little bit on Instagram and social media, and the girls spoke really openly and quite emotively about that and how hard that was, getting some of that negative feedback. The other effect, I think, which maybe we hadn't considered before, was it had an effect on the opposition, because talking to people afterwards that we'd played against are saying, you know, wow, we saw you all send out that last Insta post, that last tweet, and you were like, oh, right.
They're serious. And you're coordinated as well, that you were in agreement, you were a united team, weren't you? It gave that message too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm under no illusions that, you know, maybe some of the players of an evening had a cheeky when it's particularly when it started going well, you know, maybe they did have a cheeky look. Yeah. And you know, that's absolutely fine. It's not, you know, we're not Big Brother house, you know, you're human beings, and particularly as it was winning every game, I can imagine how tempting that would be to go and have a cheeky look. But just as long as the intent and the conversation had been had.
Yeah.
I think that was the most important.
How do you deal with the negative side of social media now? Because obviously, every now and again, that rears its ugly head.
I mean, it's definitely gotten less. Initially, after Rio in particular, it was pretty hideous for about a year.
That long?
Yeah, but not sporadically, like a lot. Yeah, sporadically. And not a lot compared to what other people get, my goodness. But it hurts. I think actually just acknowledging the fact that it hurts and why it hurts is good.
Yeah.
And then report to it and then block.
Yeah.
And then I just try and move on. I think actually the worst thing we had, and I don't remember how it got out to the Netherlands, is when we were playing in the Netherlands after Rio, it must have been sent to Bisham Abbey Hockey's training base. And there was a handwritten letter and kind of scriptures and things taken and printed out from the Bible and highlighted.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That was the hardest because you're like, wow, you've really taken some time and effort.
Serious matter. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I find it really, I'm not religious and I don't perhaps have a greater understanding as I should have. However, I do believe that all religions are about loving your fellow human. And so that's when I really started to struggle with it. I think it's great that people have really strong faith and religious beliefs, but I don't believe in any of those faiths at its core is there hatred because if somebody's got a different sexuality
to
you.
Absolutely. Love is love.
Yeah.
No, good. And I think it's something people obviously struggle with, and it's good to get some thoughts on your having been through that too. I guess moving back to Rio and that amazing final, and couldn't have been more dramatic. And I realise you tell the story many times, but that kind of end of final time and the penalties, you know, and it gets very dramatic for us as spectators at home, a huge excitement, not necessarily the result you'd have wanted on the day there. But how did you feel? Can you take yourself back now to how you felt? And I've heard just the level of practice and rehearsal that had gone into that moment. Did you have a level of confidence as they stood to take those penalties?
Yeah, I mean, to the point where when the final whistle went, I celebrated, maybe a little bit too much, because I genuinely believe in that moment we had this.
Yeah.
And I believe that because we had beaten the Netherlands on penalties at the European Championships the year before. We'd also beaten them on penalties in the European Championships in 2013. So in the lead up to Rio, actually major tournaments, we'd had a really good set of results against the Dutch. So they'd just won on penalties in the semi-final against Germany on sudden death, and I'm literally by the skin of their teeth. So I know that they're feeling nervous, anxious, under pressure right now, and so any positivity from our part at that moment was going to have another effect on them. So and coupled with the fact that I know how much statistical analysis, video analysis, practice on the field, the goalkeepers and our penalty takers had all done,
and more so than any other team, do you feel?
I think other teams practice in the same. I think other teams practice. Whether they practice in the same way, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, our players would practice taking the walk to the 25-yard line, which is the hideous part, frankly. Mm. That is lonely, and your legs start to shake, and you realise how fatigued you are, and your mind starts to tell you that you can't do this, and the goalkeeper's going to save it. And it's all of that psychology and the physical preparation together. That's where I'm not sure whether we had the advantage. I think we probably did.
Yeah, perhaps in the England football Actually, they're doing better in penalties that way. But it's been that whole nemesis of the history of penalties being the point at which we haven't succeeded in the past. So.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, what a load to bear. You know, if you're a male England footballer and it goes to penalties, you know, I can imagine in immediately you're not celebrating. You're like, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know what every is in the mind of almost
weight
every...
of the nation.
Exactly. And what the headline, you know, you're almost probably writing the headlines the next day and just some of the awful things they've had said about them, written about them. People do, you know, burning effigies and all sorts because they've missed a penalty. But now I think Gareth Southgate and his team, I think, have done a fantastic job.
I think there's a mental health and mental approach to
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
I guess one of my most abiding memories of the whole game, so thinking about this, I think I have it on my screensaver, but is you're on the podium holding that medal in both hands, sort of gazing at it, and so, so emotional in that moment. So as I ask you now, can you remember how you... You clearly can.
Yeah.
what you were feeling at that moment, in that moment?
Just so grateful and proud. It was almost a very quick flashback, you know, through everything that I'd been through to get to that point. And then not just me, also reflecting on all the women around me, the women that weren't there, who hadn't been selected, the women that had gone before us. It was just that whole... journey, I think, was just
in that moment, isn't it? And I think that's for me. It's a little bit, both swelling up a bit here.
Yeah.
But when I look at that picture, it is just you, and you are surrounded by noise and a celebration, but it is just you in that moment. And another thing, I probably know the answer to this question, but it's always been that you're, I think you're between Susanna and Sam, and I always wanted Helen to be next to you. But that's just
order.
The line, number order. I thought it must have been, but for me, always felt like it, the two of you, she was one away, wasn't she?
Yeah, number 8, number 11, Susanna, bless her heart, did ask if we wanted to
swap.
And we said, no, look, this is the order that we're in. And somebody actually captured a really nice photo when we both got our medals, and we just kind of leaned back behind Susanna and give each other a little high five. So we have that photo at home, which is nice.
And I guess then we can move on to the closing ceremony, Rio, which not gets overlooked, but almost. Yeah. But you're carrying the flag as well. So on top of that, if it could be more so, how did that feel for you?
It felt very special, particularly because we'd been so successful as a Team GB again. You know, done something that maybe nobody thought we could, and bettered the medal count in London. And just to represent those athletes, incredible athletes. And then to be kind of in the belly of the stadium waiting with all the volunteers, with all the flags, and just all the athletes from all the other countries. So I had my photo taken with Simone Biles and Caster Semenya, who I both just think are epic.
Extraordinary, yeah.
They're just most extraordinary women. And I think that made it that much more special for me to say, God, I'm here amongst them, who I look up to, and that is incredible athletes. So
and coming back to the UK, so I think sometimes, you know, we wait for something and it comes, and then there is that anticlimactic piece after. Did you experience that, or was it an ongoing kind of roller coaster of joy as you came back?
I think the first week was just madness. I just don't think we slept or sat down. It was really fun. And being in a team is that much more fun. And because we knew each other so well, however tired we were or grouchy we were, you'd be okay because my teammates get me and they know what I need right now. But then I think Helen and I took the decision to go and play in the Netherlands. And so...
Had you decided that before?
So we'd... when had we sorted that out? About 5 months before, I think, with Bloemendaal. And... I think it was the next weekend after we came back, we had to go to Germany on a pre-season trip. Now, we didn't play with Bloemendaal, but we went to go and watch and be part of the meetings and talk and meet the girls and be part of the team. So that, and they did a really nice celebration in our hotel room. They'd put balloons and things everywhere.
They made shirts.
Oh, they're so good. They were just amazing. So, and I think that was the best decision we could have ever made.
To move yourself from the madness that was.
Yeah, and I think lots of the girls who were still here, some who were going to continue playing, you know, there was the reality and then it just felt like they were going to awards. I remember seeing on Twitter they were just at awards every week, and I was like, wow, incredible to celebrate that success. But actually, in some ways, I was quite glad to be removed.
You obviously came back, and you were very much the first gay couple that had played and won gold and so on. So was there an element of you, and obviously being asked a lot about that rather than the sport, but I can recognise also it's so important that you are those role models too.
Yeah.
Was that a concern to you that became more of a story than what you'd achieved?
I don't think it was concerned us at the time, because we were very aware of the magnitude of it, and that there are still today people living in the world who will be killed, jailed because of their sexuality. And so actually just two people just talking about it in an open way was important. However, you know, I think some of our teammates, understandably, and I know Danny has said, I think the first thing he got asked in walking to the media zone after we just won that gold medal was, isn't it great Kate and Helen have won as the first same-sex couple? And he was, I think it was the Daily Mail. And yeah.
Surprise.
Yeah. And he was so angry. And it's really hard because he's not angry that we are a couple.
But the rest of the team and the squad and the coaches and the back, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so much more than that. And so that's when it's that, there have been moments when I'm just like, it's really uncomfortable. It's not, there's more here. Do more, be better, look at the wider thing. And this is a lovely part of it. Yeah. But there has been a lot that's just focused on that, and that's hard.
And I guess sport, you know, we work a lot with rugby and cricket, and it has been a place where women can very comfortably be themselves, be lesbian, be bisexual, but not so for men across team sport. And I guess that makes me really sad. I mean, you look at the proportions, there must be many men that are not living a happy life that they would wish to. Do you think that will change anytime soon?
I think we are moving towards that place. Like, do you know, even in women's sport, there are still lots of women living a double life, and that's completely up to them, of course. You know, nobody has to be open with their private lives. It's a private life, so you can keep it to yourself. But
it's sad that they can't be themselves.
It's if you feel like you can't be, then I think it's things need to be looked at. So I think women's sport is better. Particularly at grassroots level, I think it's much better. But I think elite level, it's still quite, they're still quite closeted, actually.
Because it will impact your, in theory, sponsorship, profile, media, all those things.
Yeah, and you know what? Maybe they don't want the whole focus to be about the fact that they're bisexual or lesbian. And actually, I just want to talk about
sport.
Sport, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's probably quite a big fear, and a real fear. And then for men, there is that, plus the stereotypical traditions of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a man that plays sport. And I think that the next generation coming through will demand that those traditions and stereotypes are broken. And I think, unfortunately, I think it is just time.
Yeah.
I think people are becoming to be well more educated. But that's why, you know, that's why education in schools is so important.
Yes.
And it's not about promoting anything. It's not about talking about anything's better or more than, it's just an acceptance of difference. And then in order to accept difference, you have to learn about it and understand it. And I think that has to start at the youngest age. And that's a massive debate at the moment with government in terms of what relationship education and et cetera. And I genuinely believe that's where it needs to be.
And I guess talking role models, I could make a very long list, but you're, you know, role modelling in terms of Women's Sport Trust and profile of female athletes and schoolgirls and LGBT, and then you work with Access Sport for disability and inclusivity and mental health of mine. So, you know, does that you feel the pressure to be a role model across so many different things too?
Well, no. I mean, our agents always say, you know, you can't do everything. Like, you can't. Like, and I'm like, why? Like, I'm like, why? Because I really care about all those things. And I think you can't be across everything. But it's about people, and actually just people having opportunity and being accepted for who they are and being able to flourish and thrive. And so I think all of those, you know, all those charities that you mentioned are about that.
Yeah.
And so that's you know, why I would love to do things with them. And some of it is because, you know, I was misinformed and I was uneducated, and particularly on disability sport, and thinking that, yeah, hockey's great, hockey's for everybody, and it absolutely was not. And we were, and we are still closing our doors. We're still closing our doors off.
One of my questions later, in terms of hockey being, for all we think of it, it is quite a white middle class.
Absolutely.
So can that change? Will that change, do you think?
I think we have to give everybody the opportunity to make it change. You know, whether it'll change or not isn't really, you can't force people to play hockey, but I think you have to make it
accessible,
absolutely, and available to everybody. And that is still very frustrating for me, you know. And that's, I think lots of good work is going on at grassroots. I think, unfortunately, facilities, I think, does play a part, and lack of facilities. However, I think we've become a bit elitist in terms of, oh, we have to have a water-based AstroTurf. I played on red grass. It's basically concrete. Yeah. You can play on any surface, so let's just get people playing. Yeah. And I just think at the elite level, we just have to make that more accessible. And, you know, less and less is on free-to-air TV. I think BT Sport do a brilliant, brilliant job. But I wouldn't be watching that if I was growing up. We didn't have it. Yeah. So, you know, the kind of pay-per-view. So ticket prices, let's make it so people can't turn it down, that people want to come and watch it at all costs because it's so cheap and it's a great day out.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than trying to, you know, pay for everything through the tickets. I think that's just wrong.
Excellent. That's good. And in terms of, I guess, moving on, to your transition almost from sport, we have touched on that, obviously, in terms of your role model work and so on. But how have you found that transition over the years from coming out from full-time professional, training with a squad, knowing your routine each day, to life, and a very busy life? But how do you feel that's been for?
I found it really hard. Probably still find it hard. It's the instability, I think, and the uncertainty, and that's for just for me personally. So I think other players who've gone into full-time roles. So, I mean, Georgie Twigg's a good example. She's now working at Bird and Bird.
Right.
And she has that stability of, she knows where she's going to be every day for, you know, the hours that she needs to work. And she plays club for Surbiton, and she's got, you know, she has now routine. Yeah, I think so. And I think it's that we've started to do a bit of work around values and identity and actually re-establishing that.
Yeah.
Because my circumstances have changed. And does that mean I've changed? Or actually, do I just need to go back to who I am, what I believe, what I enjoy, what I don't like, and starting to rebuild kind of my life again.
And is that harder because Helen's going through that with you at the same time? Or is that a bit of both comfort, but also there's two of you in the house?
Yeah.
Having been these professional athletes and now not.
It's helpful in that I know she understands. So if I'm just having one of those days, I can just say that and she knows exactly what I mean. I think the challenging part of it is, I guess it's a financial instability. And, you know, if we're both thinking, what do we want to do? There's not one of us who's that kind of like...
Steady.
Yeah, steady. I know I'm doing this. We're both...
She did not say, I was a bit like a mum. Freelance. I met her the other day and said, are you okay? Where's your money coming from?
Yeah.
Couldn't help myself.
No, I know. It's right. No, it's right. And we are getting to a point where she's doing her master's degree, so she's busy doing that. But I think we are now getting to the point where we're going to start building our own business.
Yes.
Consultancy and using all the things that we've learned as elite hockey players, but then and outside of that, and Helen with her psychology, around helping people thrive, whether that's in a work environment or a school environment, just getting the best out of
it. But you need to be paid. I mean, and we have a list of, look at all the things you're doing, that you do pro bono, that you do free. Ultimately, you've got food on my table and pay the mortgage, don't you, really?
Yeah.
Do you feel, I know lovely Emma Mitchell on the Lifestyle Advisors at Bisham, I think it's how we might have first met, actually, at Bisham Abbey, clearly prepare athletes for that transition without, you know, I think they do a great job. Looking back now, are there things you feel you could have done to better prepare you for this world, or is that not possible?
I mean, I think Emma Lover spent many hours with me, you know, supporting me in exploring different avenues and trying to think about what that would be,
And
it
wasn't PR. Like, you tried
I tried PR. I did. I wasn't good enough at that. But I tried also, you know, I tried sales, I tried marketing, I tried brand management. And I liked elements of all those things, but it never really gripped me. And I remember Sarah Winkless came in once to talk to the group about what she'd done after she'd retired. And she talked about this portfolio career, and I thought, that sort of sounds a bit posh. I'm not really sure I can do that. And actually, it's the thing that I know that I actually really do want is actually a little bit of that.
Variety, absolutely.
And not being in the same place every day. And I think that is something that I now genuinely love. And I am getting there. I mean, Emma, you know, I've retired nearly 3 years ago, but she's still, you know, I still see her now. And we've just started our, Helen and I have started the Athlete to Coach program with England Hockey. And I still see her through that. So there's, she is still supporting me. I don't think she could have done any more. You know, having people like Sarah Winkless come in and speak did open my eyes to the, this opportunity that I didn't even know was possible. Yeah. And inevitably, it is about people, and it's about whether that's in business or hockey, it's just helping people be the best that they can be. Yeah. I think that's it, basically.
I had a really interesting conversation that I hadn't contemplated before, really, that in Atlanta, you know, we came away with one gold in Atlanta, and then in Rio, 37 gold medals, and some of those team medals. So your value as an Olympian, a gold medal Olympian, to, you know, if you're Redgrave and Vincent, you're okay, and absolutely, you were the only ones.
Yeah.
But you're on the speaking circuit, on businesses. You've, it's, our fabulous success has made it more competitive for athletes also.
Yeah, and I think, again, so James Cracknell, I remember, said that, don't you dare think that, you know, winning this gold medal is going to set you up for the rest of your life. It's, that's not what it will do, and that's not what it's about. And he's totally right.
Yeah.
Actually, that is just the last little cherry on the top. And actually, it's all the things that you have become, learn, make you.
You use it yourself. Are you fabulous that you got that cherry on top? So there's athletes that have done the same period, whatever, and never won, never medaled in their sports, whatever reason. So you have to feel... The value has to be in the process and so on as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I know that you're coaching, you and Helen are both coaching now, and your team won the best year ever, I think, was it Hampstead and Westminster? So is that something, is coaching something that you see for the future? What are your aspirations on the coaching?
Yeah. I mean, I was just literally, just before we started talking, I was WhatsApping Sophie Bray, and we were just talking about how, even though we're out of the centralised programme now, the domestic season gives you a little bit of stability, and that's what coaching has given me back, a little bit of that continuity, that two nights a week, and at the weekend I'm about hockey, and I can be doing other things around it that's about hockey. And I have loved this season co-coaching with Sarah Kelleher, who I played with at Slough for a little bit, and then against when she played for Ireland. And she's coaching the England under 18 women's team, girls team. And so I'm learning lots from her and just lots from the players. And I just, my whole sense of being, it glows a little bit when I walk out to the hockey pitch on a freezing cold, rainy Monday night. I feel like I'm home. So it's been good.
And a national coaching role in the future, is that something that you would look to do in the future, or are you just enjoying it? Where you are now?
I mean, I kind of feel like where I end up will be where I end up. And I will become more aspirational. I mean, I think it would be incredible to be the national, any national team coach. But I think at the moment I just want to keep developing as a coach and improving as a leader in that role, and how I function as being a coach. So I think I'm just going to focus on that, and then, you know, what will be will be. Yeah,
absolutely. And I guess advice, you've obviously lived and breathed hockey for so long, so young women coming through where you were at that crossroads in your life, is there any advice that you would like to impart to them almost as they...
I think that when I go to speak in schools, my biggest thing I say is just try and work out who you want to be, and that will change. And it will develop, and your ambitions will change. And, you know, sometimes it feels like day to day, but the essence of who you are is a thing to really think about and be curious about, and give yourself time to be curious about that. And I think I just didn't do that. I just was so intent on fitting in at whatever cost that was nearly at a cost to me. And I see it everywhere I go in every school.
Yeah.
And it's just, if you can be true to yourself, you will not go far wrong in life.
And I've listened, I know, I had the pleasure to listen to you and Helen speaking in terms of corporate business talks that you're doing, a lot of that at the moment, and also some of the podcasts. You talk about finding your super strength. So
yeah.
I guess, is that a similar, kind of magnifying that, but in an adult sense too?
Yeah, I mean, it was a revelation when we did it with the team. You'd think your 31, 28 best players in the country would know what their super strengths were. We just didn't.
As individuals or in a physicality playing?
As individuals. Yeah. So, you know, I got really annoyed in the beginning that all my super strengths seemed to be off the hockey pitch. I was like, I'm supposed to be here to play hockey. I must have some super strength. But that was my job. Yeah. So, you know, that's my value. That's my worth in this team. That's who I am. And that's what my teammates need from me. And actually, in that way, they can demand it from me. And so in me knowing my strengths and you knowing my strengths, we can both get the best out of me, I can help get the best out of you, and then collectively all those little percentages add up to us all thriving and the team thriving. So when we got there, when we did that, it was just amazing. And one of the biggest differences, I think.
And when did that happen? Was that early?
So the first time we did it was, I think it was 2011. I feel like it was in San Diego with our psychologist at the time, Tom Cross. It was hard. It was really hard. Mm. It was quite, I mean, it's as hard as it is to share anything with a group of people. To stand up and say, I am exceptional at this, you know, it makes you cringe a little bit, but it's so important to own that.
Yeah. And it's women, a little bit of women, the whole, you know, imposter syndrome, I'd play it down, be a very humble, because that's more attractive. So,
it's
a trait, isn't it, to stand up and own it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still have imposter syndrome now. I don't think I can stop the internal voice when I'm, you know, speaking to a company and I are they listening to me? I'm not whilst I'm speaking. I'm not sure this is coming across really well.
I heard someone say recently, anyone that doesn't have it is probably a fraud or they're a complete psychopath. We all have it in our, there's always accepting that is as we are.
Well, I'm reading a book at the moment by Eckhart Tolle called A New Earth. So he wrote The Power of Now. He's talking about that voice and that it's the recognition of that voice that it's separate to you, that is mindfulness and awareness, and that's where, you know, you will grow. So I am aware of it.
You're listening.
Yeah.
A couple of final questions. As the podcast is called The Game Changers, and it's about trailblazing, fearless, extraordinary women. And I guess looking back another 30 years' time, what do you think you've obviously had a huge impact in this sport, but... do you ever think about what you'd like to leave as that legacy?
Wow.
It's a massive question.
Isn't it?
Sorry.
Yeah. I think it's more the legacy would be that I've helped people either on a very small scale or a large scale to really be the very best version of themselves. I think that is what I feel is... how people helped me and how I hope I can help other people. And if that means a woman in Yorkshire feels that she can go to back to hockey session once in a blue moon and be with some like-minded people who will support her, then that is it.
How could you not be inspired to be the very best version of yourself, having listened to the rather brilliant Kate Richardson-Walsh? I so enjoyed our conversation and very much look forward to following her career in the years ahead. I'd love to know what you think about the Game Changers podcast, so please do leave us a review or a rating. It does make a big difference and helps to spread the word of these amazing women in sport. And if you don't want to miss out on future episodes, you can subscribe to the Game Changers and find out more about all of my guests at promotepr.com/gamechangers. In the next podcast, you'll hear from netball legend and former England captain, Pamela Cookie. Pamela was the face of England netball for 11 years with 110 caps, and she's the only player to have won 7 league titles. It was wonderful to talk to Pamela about her amazing playing career and her work now as a netball commentator for Sky, especially as we head towards the Netball World Cup in Liverpool later this month.
Going to be out for 6 months at least, sitting on the sideline just watching all my friends and my teammates doing the sport that I love and not being able to be part of it. That was devastating for me. It was you know, when you work so hard to try and do something and then it gets taken away from you just like that.